everybody. It is time to close out the week on the Damage Report. I'm John Ederola. Brett Ehrlich is back in studio joining me.
Next time you guys watch the show, I want you to pay strict attention to the hand clapping at the end of the intro, because it's the fastest hand clapping I've ever heard.
I have not consciously ever heard that there's clapping there.
It's good to
but
be
hopefully
here.
There will be clapping at the end of this episode, because we're going to talk about a lot of important stuff through the course of this episode. We're going to be talking about healthcare, climate change, gun control, gerrymandering, Yemen, and Fox News. And stick around to the end, because we have a new study of how people differ on the policies based on whether they watch Fox News or don't, but also whether they're Republicans or not. And so you might not be too shocked to find out that Republicans who watch Fox News are different than other Republicans. But it turns out that Democrats who consume a lot of Fox News also very different on some important issues. So stick around, you're going to want to see that. That is certainly going to be something. Any other observations about the intro? Or?
None, not at all.
Okay, can I make an observation? You look very nice.
I hate
look
that
at him.
People like this.
We have forced him to be more professional. It looks like a young Ben Mankiewicz.
First
if you're just
of all,
listening to the podcast, you should watch this and see him.
It's first, anyway. The hair's a mess. I would also add that I don't like that people are giving me compliments for this ridiculous t-shirt blazer combo.
Well, no one made you wear the t-shirt. You could put on a shirt.
It's a soft t-shirt.
Do you own collared shirts? Wear them.
I do, but like—
Wear a tie.
I love wearing a tee. Love wearing myself a crew neck tee. Mm-hmm. Like a mercantile distress tee. But I leave this jackie, I call it. It's a short for jacket. I leave this jackie at work.
You do.
And I just toss it on my shoulders.
Okay.
Which is short for shoulders.
I don't think that this is a profitable route that we're traveling down right now.
I was so willing to get right into the show. Uh-huh. And you were like, do you have any more observations?
I just
about
wanted
nonsense?
To give you an opportunity, and trust me, I'm regretting it. Okay, so with that, why don't we talk about some news? Just days ago, we were lucky enough to be able to film some of a couple of different unions coming together at UCLA to protest rising income inequality there. Anyway, we put together a package. A very special politician actually showed up, so take a look.
This is John Ederola for the Damage Report, and we are at UCLA where a strike is going on. The university's Professional and Technical Employees Union, as well as a few other supporting unions, are fighting to stop what they say is rising income inequality inside of the UC system. They've been fighting on this for a couple of years with little progress so far, but today they've got a secret weapon. It's Senator Bernie Sanders.
Because I believe from the bottom of my heart that if we're going to create an economy that works for all of us and not just the 1%, we're going to have to grow the union work movement, and workers are going to have to stand up and fight back. Thank you very much.
What is the strike about? What are you hoping to achieve?
Well, mostly we're trying just to get a fair contract cost of living increase that can sustain people living in Los Angeles. It's been over almost 2 years that we've been out of contract.
Well, they're trying to privatize a lot of the work around the UC so that way they can get away from having to pay minimum wage and to keep from having to pay benefits to a lot of the workers.
People don't want to take scraps anymore.
Essentially, the university does not want to invest more resources into the people who perform the basic labor that makes this university what it is.
All of us here at UC can learn from moments like this and protests like this and think about how we want to lead moving forward, how we want to represent an example of how to treat workers.
I think that we might be getting their attention now, yes.
45% of our new hires this year alone are unbenefited and casual. UC is trying to make us the Walmart of higher education.
Amazon will not be Walmart. That's why we're striking right here and right now.
Well, I wish that I could tell you this afternoon that what's going on at the University of California is kind of unique, that this is the only institution in America where an employer is not sitting down and negotiating in good faith with its union. I wish I could tell you that the University of California is the only employer in America not paying its workers a living wage. I wish I could tell you that here at the university, it is unique that the entity is trying to privatize and outsource jobs. But if I told you that, it simply would not be true, because what we are seeing all across this country is a war being waged against the working people of America.
What does it mean for Bernie Sanders to support your strike?
Well, it's huge for us. And having Bernie here to help push our message and bring a lot of people out is just going to bring more attention to our union and our strike and our cause.
Well, his platform synchronizes with what's happening here.
Never in my entire life been around or been connected to anybody at that level of political visibility who actually is down with the people.
I really hope that Bernie being here today and talking about this today gets the other candidates to talk more about workers' rights. You know, they're not asking for a lot. They're just asking to be able to take care of themselves.
There's a question of, are politicians authentic anymore, right? Including especially the Democrats. But here's a guy who's actually coming here and doing it and building it with people. And I think that just means a lot for all of us.
Now, the University of California is one of the great university systems in the world. The University of California must not be a corporate-type employer.
So we just got done talking to a number of representatives of the different unions that were arrayed here, as well as listening to their speakers, including Bernie Sanders. And two things were very clear to me. One, the idea that unions have been neutered by this administration and a multi-decade-long campaign to strip them of their power is not true. They are strong, getting stronger, and fighting back. And also, Bernie Sanders is already demonstrating his pro-worker credentials. Other candidates, there are so many running this primary, are going to need to do that. Their rhetoric is not going to be enough if they want to claim the mantle of being the pro-worker candidate. They need to be out here the same as Bernie Sanders, actually on the picket line supporting the unions that are fighting to get what they deserve. It was a really invigorating experience covering it. Hopefully we'll see more strikes like this in the future.
And I wish that I could name names. I can't because they wouldn't. But the unions, I spoke to the presidency's unions, they said that they had reached out to other candidates as well, but only Bernie showed up.
Interesting, John. I
don't know which
candidates. That was a really great package.
Thank you. Alex did a great job editing it, and we had a great team together.
Asher, they're all out there.
Yep, and Craig as well, putting them together.
Who cares about Craig?
Yeah, he's pretty cool, though. So anyway, it was great to be around all these people. You had a lot of people that worked for the unions that were there. They've been engaged in this fight for literally years, and thankfully someone like Bernie Sanders showed up so that there were news vans. Like, people were actually covering it, and they've said that they have not been able to get that sort of attention in past instances. But you had a lot of students as well, some there because, as you saw, one student talking about because of how much they care about what is happening to their teachers, the employees at the university, but others because they were excited to see Bernie Sanders.
And I know it's only been 2 days since you went, but is there any indication that this will create any progress, some tangible change?
I haven't heard anything just yet, but we'll see. As I said, it's something that's been ongoing for some time.
Copy. Well done.
Anyway, let's move on to a related topic. Bernie Sanders recently was talking about how our healthcare system, how much we have to pay into it versus other major countries, as he likes to say. There's gigantic inequalities there. And the way he pointed out was through giving birth. And he said in the United States, it costs on average $12,000 to have a baby. In Finland, it costs $60. We've got to end the disgrace of our profit-driven healthcare system and pass Medicare for All. And so you might see that and think, oh, that's a very standard sort of Bernie Sanders thing, pointing out the ridiculous, like, why would it cost so much more here than in Finland? Seems totally reasonable. To reasonable people, maybe, but not everybody is reasonable. So Nikki Haley, formerly of the Trump administration, she responded by saying, all right, Bernie Sanders, you're not the woman having the baby, so I wouldn't be out there talking about skimping on a woman when it comes to childbirth. Trust me. Nice try, though.
Okay, keep that up. The you're not the woman having the baby, so stay out of it, essentially, is an argument from a pro-lifer saying you're not the woman having the baby, stay away from this issue. That mm-hmm. is very frustrating to hear. Uh-huh. And then the idea that you're skimping in other countries by just having a lower cost for healthcare. That, as you'll probably prove, is completely ridiculous.
Yeah, what does she think she's saying? And obviously, it was ratioed and all that. Because did she not carefully read what he said? We're not saying we want to skimp. We're saying there is no justifiable explanation based in the care received that it should cost many times more, as was pointed out. But also understand, I don't know if you looked at the timestamps on those tweets. It's bizarre to miss his point by itself. It's even more bizarre to quote retweet a 2-week-old tweet to misunderstand his point. That was a weeks old thing that she was dredging back up to get so wrong, which is very bizarre.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the facts. I know that she's probably not that interested, but we're gonna jump ahead a little bit. According to the CIA fact book, the maternal mortality rate in the USA is nearly 5 times higher than Finland. In other words, USA much more expensive system, which is much more likely to kill mothers while they're giving birth.
That's so what he's talking about.
If anybody is skimping, perhaps it's us, because the results literally, it's not just like, oh, did I have a fun experience? It's the difference between life and death for many of these people.
Mm-hmm. She also she's trying to imply that the people in Finland are not happy with their health care. She basically said, like,
ask them what they think.
Yes.
So we've got some of those.
Well, yeah, but recently the Finnish government did resign over their inability to curb health care costs.
Oh, so, that sounds bad.
That does sound bad. They were angry that they could only keep the rising health care costs to 2.4% per year. They thought that was a failure enough to resign their entire government. In America, on average over the last 2 years, we have over a 5% increase in healthcare costs, which is twice that number.
Trump should double resign.
He should double resign.
Yeah.
It's just very frustrating. It costs less per person to have healthcare in Finland than it does here, and the care is better.
Yeah, yeah. Important. I would say in a birth, there's two important things that need to happen. One, the baby needs to come out and survive, and two, the mother needs to survive. And we're failing on one of those at the very least. So bear that in mind. Also, she said to ask people from Finland. Some of them did respond. Amelia says, it's awesome. Thanks for asking. Expecting my third child and once again enjoying free prenatal care. Looking forward to giving birth. I can get a natural birth in a tub, epidural, C-section, or anything else for the same 30 to 60 their currency.
Squiggle money.
Their currency.
I
think I know what it is, but I don't want to guess. I have not spent much time in Finland, I'm going to be honest. I've spent more time in Sweden and Norway. Finnish individual said, our daughter was born 2 months prematurely, spent 3 weeks in intensive care, and my wife was hospitalized for 2 weeks. Cost something like a couple of hundred euros. They might well be on the euro. I feel sorry for all the not rich people in the US. So we appreciate that. Thank you. We're trying to catch up to you guys. And Sari says, my heart surgery in Finland costs 60. When my son was born, I had to be in the hospital for 3 weeks. It didn't cost me anything. Because of my high risk pregnancy, I was checked by a doctor once a week for free. So look, and here's the thing. I can understand why Nikki Haley would not actually know what's going on in any country outside of the US. If she had just been a former governor, but she was actually a representative of the UN. She should know a little bit about what's going on, especially in Europe, since she spent so much time there.
Correct.
Anyway, thank you, Bernie Sanders, for your advocacy, actually wanting to really help American mothers and those giving birth, rather than just, you know, some snarky tweets that don't actually get to the heart of what the problems really are for these people. Anyway, we are going to take a short break. When we come back, climate change. Has the media been doing a better job of covering it? We're going to break that down with the help of Media Matters.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, you must unlearn what you have learned. And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today. And get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
If you watch the news, you probably know that they don't necessarily do a great job of covering climate change. But what you might not know is they're actually getting worse at it. So that's awesome. Joining us now to break this down, Lisa Hymas of Media Matters has been doing some research in this area. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for joining us. So you recently, you have compared the last couple of years of broadcast network coverage of climate change, how much they've actually been talking about this, and what did you find?
Well, the short answer is our findings were terrible. So we at Media Matters, our climate team, every year looks at how the broadcast TV networks do, how often they cover climate change at all. Mm-hmm. And we found that in 2018, coverage is actually down 45% from 2017. So even as the climate change, even as the climate crisis is getting so much worse, it's ramping up, it's heating up both metaphorically and literally, the broadcast networks are covering it less, which is really alarming.
And so that, I mean, I guess I would have to know a little bit more about the nature of their coverage, because it seems like, even though it can be difficult to directly link any one extreme weather event to climate change more generally, it's an opportunity at the very least for the media to talk about the subject. And last year we had a number of these sorts of events. I mean, here in California we had massive fires breaking all records. So did they use those opportunities at the very least when covering extreme weather events? Did they at least briefly talk about climate change?
Most of the time they did not. And then that was, I agree with you. I mean, that's one of the great opportunities. That's one of the moments when it makes, when you can connect climate change to people's everyday lives, you know, when real people are feeling the effects, you know, when that's when a big hurricane hits, or when wildfires hit communities, or when there are extreme storms. And very infrequently do the broadcast networks incorporate climate change when they report on those kinds of events. So there were two major hurricanes that hit the U.S. last year, Florence and Michael, both caused a lot of damage. None of the broadcast networks mentioned climate change in any of their coverage of those on their nightly news shows and their Sunday morning political shows. So that's one big area where they're just completely falling down on the job. You know, because the science connecting climate change and extreme weather events keeps getting better and better. I mean, even as Hurricane Florence was heading toward the U.S., there was a report coming out saying that climate change made that storm more intense. And the coverage, you know, the science around wildfires and how climate change primes the land for those, how it can exacerbate them and make them worse, that is getting stronger too. There are more and more reasons for the broadcast networks to be making those connections, but they're still largely falling down.
So I'm curious, as you were going back through the actual coverage that they did have, to the limited extent that they talked about it at all, was their coverage, was it diverse? Did it include actual scientists as opposed to just having fake debates between deniers and people who accept it? Would you say that it was substantive coverage when they did talk about it?
Some of it was. I mean, the things that probably got the most coverage were a couple of major climate reports that came out in the latter half of 2018. So the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released a major report on the dangers we face from temperatures between global average temperatures rising between 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius. And then the U.S. government released the National Climate Assessment. 13 federal agencies contributed to that and described how climate change is affecting America now and how it will affect it in the future. Those reports did get some coverage, and some of it was straight and pretty decent. There were some scientists who were included in the coverage. I mean, sometimes they still had folks on commenting who didn't really know what they were talking about. I mean, the biggest misinformer on this is our president, Donald Trump. You know, they would keep showing his tweets or him making skeptical statements and incorporating that into their coverage, which is disappointing.
So this next question, this might be a little bit outside of the bounds of your research, but I am curious because you've watched a lot of this type of coverage. And as I try to figure out why it is that they might not talk about this topic very much, there's a few potential reasons. I think one is that it's not always necessarily the sexiest sort of topic to discuss. And I know that from my own personal experience, I mean, we talk about it constantly here, and yet I know reliably that it's not going to get nearly as much exposure or interest as a lot of other topics. Based on what you have seen, Do you have any advice that you can provide either to me or other people in the media in how to communicate about climate change in a way that can avoid some of the problems that perhaps leads networks not to cover it as much as they could?
I mean, I think one suggestion is just to incorporate climate change into a lot of different kinds of coverage. I mean, I think one problem that we often see in the mainstream media, not so much with you guys, is that climate change is siloed. So if, you know, if there's a big report about climate change, they'll report on it. But they don't. But when there are, when there's news around energy development or, you know, the business sector, do they talk about how climate change plays into that? You know, if there's a big new real estate development going in, how is that going to be affected as sea levels rise or as, you know, things go forward? I mean, climate change is an economic story. It's a business story. It's a culture story. It's a politics story. But too often, it just gets thought of in this really narrow band as an environmental story. And we should be beyond that at this point.
Well, that seems like very good advice, and I will try to bear that in mind in the future. I want to thank you again for joining us, Lisa Hymas, Director of the Climate and Energy Program at Media Matters for America. We really appreciate the work you're doing.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me on.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, schools are doing some training about the possibility of gun violence. Not necessarily the most productive type of training. We'll break it down after this. Okay, so it's very common to say that we in America are not doing anything about gun violence, particularly gun violence hitting schools. But that's not fair. They are doing something. Take a look at this headline. Apparently, teachers were told to kneel before being shot with pellets during active shooter training. This is real.
That may or may not be the actual incident itself, but it looks like everyone who's not getting shot is having a good time.
Yeah, that might not be it, but I have a feeling that whatever it actually was, it doesn't look much better because that is actually what was done. This is at Meadowlawn Elementary in Indiana. It's part of their ALICE training. Alert, lockdown, inform, counter, and shoot teachers in the back with pellets.
No.
I think that's what it stands for, actually.
Evacuate, John. Oh,
evacuate, yes. Evacuate after shooting in the back with pellets. So, yes, teachers were asked by local law enforcement to kneel down against the classroom wall before being sprayed across their backs with plastic pellets without warning. And if you think, well, that's the worst thing I've heard in a while, it gets worse. They weren't told that that was going to happen. It just happened to them. An anonymous teacher, probably anonymous because he doesn't want to get sprayed with more pellets, said, "They told us this is what happens if you just cower and do nothing. They shot all of us across our backs. I was hit 4 times. It hurt so bad."
Like, think of that moment. Like, you're getting shot, and there, and someone whose job this is yelling at you and making you feel terrible.
This is what happens.
Like, I get it. I can see, like, the warped mind of someone who's, like, in this kind of thing all the time. Like, the trainers. Like, I deal with these kind of intense situations all the time. Mm-hmm. I want you to experience the helplessness and fear that might be associated with this. However, they didn't tell anyone that they were going to inflict pain on them.
Injure
as part
them.
Of a job exercise that a lot of them were like, yes, I'm into learning what to do in an emergency situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, well, look, we're gonna go through the developments after the injuries because things have developed, but White County Sheriff Bill Brooks said, it's a soft round projectile. The key here is soft. Well, the key might be soft, but apparently it also is affiliated with other keys like welt and bleeding. Because one teacher said she had welts in one spot where the pellet broke her skin. It was scabbed over for several weeks. He responded by saying, they all knew they could be shot. It's a shooting exercise. Okay, so the only good thing here is that apparently Dwight Schrute did find new work after The Office. That is the only positive to come out of this. Because this is exactly the sort of training he used to do.
So the sheriff in the area is no longer using these pellets. They basically, this happened in January, and then after, like, according to him, a few weeks later, we didn't even know they didn't like it. But a few weeks later, they started complaining about how they got shot with pellets, leaving welts and broken skin. Mm-hmm. And so these are all like his responses to it. He's like, I don't need a rule about it, but I'll stop. However, you guys are being kind of wussies about it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's reassuring. Look, again, as I always say, I always reassure you guys, I am not, in fact, a psychic. I cannot go into people's minds. But if you're the sort of person that wants to surprise grown adults by shooting them in the back, that maybe means something.
But they weren't. They didn't know they were going to be shot.
That's the surprise part of it.
What is it? The people who spoke to the paper said that they were given paintball masks, which law enforcement said were a precaution for different scenarios throughout the training. Mm-hmm. That was the wording that they gave. Here's a paintball. Okay, fine. But like, imagine it's like we're going to learn what to do in case of an active shooter. Also, here's some paintball masks. Mm-hmm. What? Also, can you face the wall really quick?
Yeah.
Okay.
It seems
and
like a power
also,
trip.
We're going to shoot you in the back a bunch of time with airsoft guns. So airsoft guns have these pellets that are a little bit bigger than a BB gun. Mm-hmm. They say they're soft, but obviously they're not. They create welts. And obviously the people who are shooting them knew that because by their own logic, they're saying, I want you to have negative affiliations, including pain that go along with just sitting there and getting shot and doing nothing.
Yeah. And so look, I think that this should be a reminder that it's not necessarily always a great idea to give the unilateral responsibility and decision-making process of whether force should be used to people who can't necessarily be counted on to use it responsibly.
Right, and there's a lot of criticism of this. The way that the training actually happens is there's a central facility that trains people mm-hmm. how to also train other people. Mm-hmm. So in this article by the Indianapolis Star, they also said that essentially what happens is it's a game of telephone. So you go to the main training
and then
you learn it and then it gets disseminated to other people. And they say it's not a normal practice. It doesn't happen a lot, which
really?
Kind of makes you wonder, like, apparently it happened in, they use these airsoft guns, whether they use the ammunition or not. They show up with guns. You saw in the one photo, it looks like a Nerf gun, but other airsoft guns look like regular guns, but they simply have an orange circle at the end of the muzzle.
Yeah, I get that, yeah.
But it's horrible. They did say that there were certain aspects of this training that they did like one instance when they were told to cower under a table, but they were given tennis balls to chuck at the person who was simulating the shooter. So they were told to throw these things at the shooter until he stopped.
Yeah, that should be effective. You're going to have to hit him with a few hundred. I've seen American Gladiators. The first one doesn't usually stop the person.
Gemini.
So look, it might be that there are some people engaged in this program, the people who designed it originally. Best intentions. They want to help the situation. But to me, all of this is Donald Trump tweeting at George Conway. It is a complete distraction from actually fixing the problem. None of this, no matter how many pellets you shoot a chemistry teacher in the back with, is going to actually stop the problem of kids and teachers being massacred in their schools thanks to a combination of a sick culture with tons and tons of guns.
Right.
We could do something. We're maybe less likely to do something when we feel like we're doing something. When we have the ALICE program and other things like this, it feels like we're being responsible, like we're addressing the problem, but we're not addressing the problem. We just saw yesterday, New Zealand showed how to address the problem by addressing the problem, by actually making it harder to get the guns that these people so commonly use. And I want to give credit again to AOC for pointing that out in response to this story, saying, you know, instead of training children, teachers, houses of faith, and concert goers to prep for being shot, we could just pass universal background checks, disarm domestic abusers, mandate safe storage, ban bump stocks, semi-autos, and high-cap mags designed to kill people. Now, that wouldn't necessarily stop all of these, but it certainly would make it less likely. And that is something that cannot necessarily be said for shooting people with airsoft bullets.
True.
Okay, let's move on just briefly. The AP conducted an analysis that really won't come as a shock, I suppose, but we know that gerrymandering is out of control in this country. We just had midterm elections, so how important was gerrymandering for Republicans? Now, they lost control of the House, but is it actually a little bit better than it could have been? The AP's analysis indicates that Republicans won about 16 more U.S. House seats than they would have been expected based on their average share of the vote in congressional districts across the country. In state House elections, Republicans' structural advantage might have helped them hold on to as many as 7 chambers that otherwise could have flipped to Democrats. So in any one of these cases, we can't say for sure that their analysis is 100% accurate, but we do know that the results, the wave that we had, could have been even wavier if it had not been for gerrymandering and other structural advantages that Republicans have baked into the system over the past decade.
Right. And this happens at the federal, like for the U.S. Congress, for state congresses. Basically, whoever is in charge in the years after a census comes through, mm-hmm. and the census is what they use to kind of redraw maps, that group redraws the districts, and that's always in their own favor. For example, Pennsylvania Michigan and North Carolina in the last election voted more for Democrats than they did for Republicans, but the Republicans were able to get a majority in those state houses.
Yeah.
So Pennsylvania, 54% of Democrats, 54 Democrats got 54% of the vote, but 45% of the seats. Yeah. In Michigan, they got 53% of the vote, 47% of the seats. And then in North Carolina, they got 51% of the vote and 45% of the seats. Yeah. It's just so frustrating. And that's one of those stats that you look at and you just, this doesn't seem fair. It happens in these states for Republicans. It's happened in Massachusetts for Democrats. It's just something that doesn't seem intuitive or fair, much like the Electoral College. And it's something that people assume is baked into America as we define it, but does it have to be?
It doesn't have to be, yeah. And I mean, look, some Republicans will say, well, if the Democrats take over, they'll just do the same thing. Well, historically, they don't necessarily, not as often and not as terribly. But awesome, okay, let's have the Democrats not be in charge of it either. There are other options. Mm-hmm. And in terms of making the vote more reflective of what the people actually want, I'm gonna jump ahead briefly. In Pennsylvania, the Supreme Court there redrew the congressional map for the 2018 elections after striking down the previous Republican-drawn version as an unconstitutional partisan gerrymander. The Republican tilt there was cut by more than half between 2016 to 2018 as a result of that, as the state's congressional delegation went from a 13-5 GOP majority to an even split of 9 seats each for Republicans and Democrats. Although, as Brett pointed out, the Democrats got the majority of the vote there. They theoretically should have had a 10-8 split there, but at least it's a little bit more in line with what the people actually want. So this is a gigantic problem. It is in a number of states, but it is a problem that can be dealt with. If you elect the right people at the lower levels, they will be there to make sure that we don't get these completely unjust allocations of power at the higher levels. Okay, we're going to take a short break. We come back and update on the situation in Yemen, the conflict there, after this. So we've had some recent developments on the Saudi-led conflict in Yemen, which of course the US has traditionally been quite involved in. Successful votes in Congress. Where do we go from here? Joining us now to help break it down is Hassan El-Tayeb, co-director of Just Foreign Policy. Hassan, welcome to the show.
Hey there, thanks.
Well, thank you for coming back and joining us. We've talked previously about this issue. We have now had, since the new year, successful votes to pull the US out of this conflict in both the House and the Senate. How did you react with that most recent Senate vote?
Well, it was another historic win for the Yemen War Powers Resolution. The bill SJ Res 7 passed with a bipartisan majority, 54-46. So I'm really excited. We're heading on to the House of Representatives next. So we're expecting our next vote probably the first week of April and hopefully getting it on the president's desk as soon as possible.
Well, that would certainly be a good development. I wish that they could have done it even faster. But assuming that it does get on Trump's desk, I guess there's the possibility that he will continue his recent trend of vetoing it. If he does do that, what do you think will happen?
Well, just to take a step back, there's actually one last thing that Republicans might try to do. It's called to derail our efforts here. It's called a motion to recommit. It's one last procedural hurdle that the minority party will get a chance to introduce. They tried it last time, and they basically added non-germane language to the bill condemning anti-Semitism, which everyone agrees with, but unfortunately it lost our privileged status. So we're trying to get the grassroots organizations to come together and block the motion to recommit. And let's just say we pass the bill, we're expecting to. And it lands on the front on Trump's desk, and he vetoes. Well, then it goes back to Congress, and they have one more chance to overturn that veto with a 2/3 majority in both chambers. If we don't, then we have to go through other means. We have to go after it through appropriations. McGovern has a piece of legislation that I think would also, you know, cut support for the Saudi coalition. And just defunding every piece of our involvement in this horrible conflict.
So things have certainly they've moved quickly. They've accelerated in recent months on this issue. I feel like obviously the US has been involved in it for some time here on this show. I mean, we've been talking with representatives of your organization, anti-war activists and Ro Khanna about this for what feels like eternity. And now we have what looks like possibly a turning point. I'm trying to learn some general lessons from this. What do you think were the most important factors in actually getting the Congress to finally act. It had seemed like a long time, like for a long time, that there was actually enough people to pull us out, but they wouldn't actually go on the record. What do you think caused that change?
Well, I think what's been so wonderful about this is our bipartisan coalition. The fact that we're getting folks to reassert constitutional war authority, we're advocating for it. I mean, this coalition goes from the far left to the far right, even with the Koch brothers, Code Pink, you know, Yemeni activist groups. So I think the diversity and the broadness of our coalition is part of it. And the fact that we're using the principles of the Constitution in Article 1, Section 8. I also think that the War Powers Act is key. In 1973, they passed this, and inside that bill, that historic bill, was a mechanism to force votes. And you could, it doesn't matter if you're on House Foreign Affairs, doesn't matter, you know, what committee you sit on, you can force the entire Congress to make votes. And yeah, each time we made Congress vote, we got a little bit closer and closer. We had a vote in November 2017. We barely had 30 representatives on that bill in the House. And then, you know, flash forward, look at where we are today. So,
yeah. While you're talking about the War Powers Act, I mean, we might be seeing the U.S. pull out of this conflict. At the same time, there are conflicts hypothetically on the horizon with in recent days, Donald Trump and Bolsonaro, sort of alluded to the possibility of some sort of military action against Venezuela. Obviously, there is a continual talk in that direction in regard to Iran. How concerned are you that even as we pull out of this conflict, we might be entering into more in the near future?
You're right. It's definitely a major concern. The escalation of tensions with Venezuela is a huge issue. Representative Cicilline, though, he introduced another piece of legislation that invokes the War Powers Act in H.R. 1004, the Prohibition Against Military Action in Venezuela Act. And, you know, we got about 54 co-sponsors on that piece of legislation. So I think you're going to see Congress continue to flex its muscles and get, you know, now we've sort of trained a lot of these members of Congress to, and their staff in particular, to be watching out for this and to know that there's a large coalition of people that want them to reassert constitutional war authority. So we have to just kind of keep hammering it home. And, you know, obviously a lot to be concerned about, but there's a glimmer of hope here that Congress wants to, you know, not allow the executive branch to run over them.
Well, that would certainly be a positive development. Hassan Al-Tayeb, co-director of Just Foreign Policy, thank you for joining us on the Damage Report.
Thanks.
We're going to take one last break. When we come back, the Fox News effect, stronger perhaps than we'd previously thought, and not just on Republicans, after this. Okay, look, I've done what I can to warn people away from even accidentally being exposed to the toxin that is Fox News, but even I didn't understand how generalized its negative impact can be on different sorts of people. But Navigator Research looked into it, and they looked at how people who watch Fox News or don't, those who are Republicans or not, respond to different questions. And they found some really interesting stuff. So overall, hold on, you'll get a chance, Brett Ehrlich.
Sorry, I put my hand in frame, my bad.
Overall, look, 12% of GOP Fox viewers believe climate change is mostly caused by humans compared to 62% of all other Americans. Jesus, I mean, if you found out that your media outlet was that wrong, that should be something, but let's go through some more. 77% of GOP Fox viewers are very concerned about the Democratic Party moving in too socialist a direction compared to just 20% of all others, a 57-point difference. 89% of GOP Fox viewers express support for the Republican tax law compared to just 22% of all others, that's a 67-point difference. 20% support the special counsel investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election, compared to 67% of all others, showing again what the hard work of Sean Hannity over the course of the past few years has been able to accomplish. 78% believe that the Trump administration has accomplished more than any other administration in history, compared to just 17% of all others. That is a 61-point difference. And all of that is gigantic. Republicans who watch Fox News are like nothing like other people in society. So, but there's another layer. Before we get to that other layer, though, overall,
so
does this matter at all? Are you surprised at all?
It sounds great.
I mean, it doesn't sound great to me.
It sounds, no, this is what I mean. It sounds great to have some way of having you insulated from reality and other people based on your simple preference of what to watch. Like, I watch Game of Thrones to escape, and I do that for however many hours Game of Thrones lasts. But these people have 24 hours a day watch their equivalent of Game of Thrones, which allows them to disappear into this other world forever.
Yeah.
Forever.
But do you believe that at you having watched Game of Thrones has such a sharp, a 50 to 70 point difference on how you would answer the questions?
I do believe in dragons.
I do think
that's it.
Yeah. So that's here. Look, that's the overall thing. Look, what's interesting, and we're going to show you some examples, is that Republicans who watch Fox versus Republicans who don't watch Fox, there could be pretty big differences. So again, they're Republicans. It's just whether they watch Fox or not. They have huge disagreements on some of these issues. But it turns out that Democrats are not immune to it either. So let's go through an example to show you this. So, do you agree with the statement that President Trump was right to declare a national emergency in order to start building a border wall? So you're seeing some dots there. The dark blue, that is a non-Republican, non-Fox viewers. So they're not Republicans and they don't watch Fox. Only 7% agree. On the far right, you see the red, 84% of Republican Fox viewers think that he was right. But it's really in the middle that's so interesting. So there is a 34% difference, 34-point difference between Republicans who watch or don't watch Fox News. So Fox's effect on Republicans is massive, but it also has an effect on non-Republicans. There's a 21-point gap in non-Republicans based on whether they watch Fox or not. So those are people who don't consider themselves to be Republicans. They're maybe independents, maybe libs, and they are affected by the rhetoric as well. Let's go to another example, and you'll see the same thing. In 2 years, the Trump administration has accomplished more than almost any other administration in US history, which it should take a lot to answer affirmatively to that, because it's a ridiculous thing to say. But there is a huge gap again on Republicans based on whether they watch Fox News. Almost every Republican who watches Fox News believes that he is literally the best administration ever. But amongst non-Republicans, there's a 12-point gap. You're four times as likely to answer affirmatively just if you're watching Fox News. And by the way, this is true on almost every one of the questions that they asked. So non-Republicans, if you watch Fox News, you're much more scared now about socialism in the Democratic Party than if you're a non-Republican who doesn't watch Fox News.
I will say that the numbers you're saying are interesting in relation to general media coverage outside of Fox News, because you already showed statistics saying people that are concerned about whether any given party, the Democrats, are becoming too socialist. I watch a lot of CNN, Fox News, and MSNBC. When I watch CNN, which is supposed to be the independent arbiter, even though only 22% of all other people are, I guess, what is the socialist one? I think it's somewhere around there. 20% of people, one in five people, is concerned that the Democrats are being socialist or too socialist. But every day, on every broadcast, it seems, from CNN, they ask that question. They have bought that framing. So they are painting the world in that way, regardless of how people actually feel about it. And this is just a concern question. This isn't a this is happening question.
Yeah.
We are planting it in your head so that you can make a decision on it now. Yeah. It's not asking what are your concerns about the Democratic Party. I mean, even when you frame it in terms of socialism, only one in five people say socialism.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I think, look, certainly on the issue that you're spotlighting, but probably on others, I mean, I would like to see this done for CNN and MSNBC as well. There might not be huge gaps in the effect they're having on topics like that. You know, like raising taxes on the wealthy. I think that regardless of which of the big three you watch, you're generally, that's not spoken of in a favorable sense. I think that's true. But on some areas, like whether climate change is caused by human action, the special counsel investigation, whether Trump is the best thing ever, that's probably more of a Fox thing, I would guess.
I would say framing, and the keys are framing and repetition in messaging across the board, as well as like the tropes of news communication are able to get this done. Cenk's been pointing this out on the main show a lot lately, which the Young Turks a lot lately, which is if you say the same thing over and over again, it gets through potentially. But at the same time, you just need to repeat as incessantly the poll numbers, like 90% of people support gun background checks, you know, those kinds of stats.
Yeah, people need to know what is actually true. Climate change is real. Flint still doesn't have access to clean water. We should be repeating these sorts of things so that people understand them. Anyway, I wish we had more time. Thank you so much, Brad.
You're welcome.
You're the best. It's great to have you on here.
I am the strongest.
Thank you, everybody who's been watching throughout the week. We're going to be back next week. So much to get to. Ro Khanna, next week. We'll see you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.